Part 3. The Production of Absolute Surplus Value. Chapter 7. The Labour Process and the Process of Producing Surplus Value. Section 1. The Labour Process or the Production of Use Values. The capitalist buys labour power in order to use it, and labour power, in use, is labour itself. The purchaser of labour power consumes it by setting the seller of it to work. By working, the latter becomes actually what before he only was potentially, labour power in action, a labourer. In order that his labour may reappear in a commodity, he must, before all things, expend it on something useful, on something capable of satisfying a want of some sort. Hence, what the capitalist sets the labourer to produce is a particular use value, a specified article. The fact that the production of use values, or goods, is carried on under the control of a capitalist and on his behalf does not alter the general character of that production. We shall, therefore, in the first place, have to consider the labour process independently of the particular form it assumes under given social conditions. Labour is, in the first place, a process in which both man and nature participate, and in which man, of his own accord, starts, regulates, and controls the material reactions between himself and nature. He opposes himself to nature as one of her own forces, setting in motion arms and legs, head and hands, the natural forces of his body, in order to appropriate nature's productions in a form adapted to his own wants. By thus acting on the external world and changing it, he at the same time changes his own nature. He develops his slumbering powers and compels them to act in obedience to his sway. We are not now dealing with those primitive instinctive forms of labour that remind us of the mere animal. An immeasurable interval of time separates the state of things in which a man brings his labour power to market for sale as a commodity from that state in which human labour was still in its first instinctive stage. We presuppose labour in a form that stamps it as exclusively human. A spider conducts operations that resemble those of a weaver, and a bee puts to shame many an architect in the construction of her cells. But what distinguishes the worst architect from the best of bees is this, that the architect raises his structure in imagination before he erects it in reality. At the end of every labour process, we get a result that already existed in the imagination of the labourer at its commencement. He not only effects a change of form in the material on which he works, but he also realises a purpose of his own that gives the law to his modus operandi, and to which he must subordinate his will. And this subordination is no mere momentary act. Besides the exertion of the bodily organs, the process demands that, during the whole operation, the workman's will be steadily in consonance with his purpose. This means close attention. The less he is attracted by the nature of the work and the mode in which it is carried on, and the less, therefore, he enjoys it as something which gives play to his bodily and mental powers, the more close his attention is forced to be. The elementary factors of the labour process are, 1, the personal activity of man, that is, work itself, 2, the subject of that work, and 3, its instruments. The soil, and this, economically speaking, includes water, in the virgin state in which it supplies man with the necessaries or the means of subsistence, ready to hand, exists independently of him, and is the universal subject of human labour. Footnote. The earth's spontaneous productions being in small quantity and quite independent of man appear, as it were, to be furnished by nature in the same way as a small sum is given to a young man in order to put him in a way of industry and of making his fortune. James Stewart, Principles of Political Economy, Dublin, 1770. End of footnote. All those things which labour merely separates from immediate connection with their environment are subjects of labour spontaneously provided by nature. Such are fish which we catch and take from their element, water, timber which we fell in the virgin forest, and ores which we extract from their veins. If, on the other hand, the subject of labour has, so to say, been filtered through previous labour, we call it raw material. Such is ore already extracted and ready for washing. All raw material is the subject of labour, but not every subject of labour is raw material. It can only become so after it has undergone some alteration by means of labour. An instrument of labour is a thing, or a complex of things, which the labourer interposes between himself and the subject of his labour, and which serves as the conductor of his activity. He makes use of the mechanical, physical, and chemical properties of some substances in order to make other substances subservient to his aims. Footnote. Reason is just as cunning as she is powerful. Her cunning consists principally in her mediating activity, which, by causing objects to act and react on each other in accordance with their own nature in this way, without any direct interference in the process, carries out reason's intentions. Hegel, Berlin, 1840. End of footnote. Leaving out of consideration such ready-made means of subsistence as fruits, in gathering which a man's own limbs serve as the instruments of his labour, the first thing of which the labourer possesses himself is not the subject of labour, but its instrument. Thus, nature becomes one of the organs of his activity, one that he annexes to his own bodily organs, adding stature to himself in spite of the Bible. As the earth is his original larder, so too it is his original tool-house. It supplies him, for instance, with stones for throwing, grinding, pressing, cutting, etc. The earth itself is an instrument of labour, but when used as such in agriculture implies a whole series of other instruments, and a comparatively high development of labour. Footnote. In his otherwise miserable work, Théorie de l'économie politique, Paris, 1815, Ganil enumerates in a striking manner, in opposition to the physiocrats, the long series of previous processes necessary before agriculture, properly so called, can commence. End of footnote. No sooner does labour undergo the least development than it requires specially prepared instruments. Thus, in the oldest caves we find stone implements and weapons. In the earliest period of human history, domesticated animals, that is, animals which have been bred for the purpose and have undergone modifications by means of labour, play the chief part as instruments of labour along with specially prepared stones, wood, bones, and shells. Footnote. Turgot, in his Réflexions sur la formation et la distribution des richesses, 1766, brings well into prominence the importance of domesticated animals to early civilization. End of footnote. The use and fabrication of instruments of labour, although existing in the germ among certain species of animals, is specifically characteristic of the human labour process, and Franklin therefore defines man as a tool-making animal. Relics of bygone instruments of labour possess the same importance for the investigation of extinct economic forms of society as do fossil bones for the determination of extinct species of animals. It is not the articles made, but how they are made and by what instruments, that enables us to distinguish different economic epochs. Footnote. The least important commodities of all, for the technological comparison of different epochs of production, are articles of luxury, in the strict meaning of the term. However little our written histories up to this time notice the development of material production, which is the basis of all social life and therefore of all history, yet prehistoric times have been classified in accordance with the results, not of so-called historical, but of materialistic investigations. These periods have been divided to correspond with the materials from which their implements and weapons were made, viz. Into the stone, the bronze, and the iron ages. End of footnote. Instruments of labour not only supply a standard of the degree of development to which human labour has attained, but they are also indicators of the social conditions under which that labour is carried on. Among the instruments of labour, those of a mechanical nature which, taken as a whole, we may call the bone and muscles of production, offer much more decided characteristics of a given epoch of production than those which, like pipes, tubs, baskets, jars, etc., serve only to hold the materials for labour, which latter class we may in a general way call the vascular system of production. The latter first begins to play an important part in the chemical industries. In a wider sense, we may include among the instruments of labour, in addition to those things that are used for directly transferring labour to its subject and which therefore, in one way or another, serve as conductors of activity, all such objects as are necessary for carrying on the labour process. These do not enter directly into the process, but without them it is either impossible for it to take place at all, or possible only to a partial extent. Once more we find the earth to be a universal instrument of this sort, for it furnishes a locus standi to the labourer and a field of employment for his activity. Among instruments that are the result of previous labour and also belong to this class, we find workshops, canals, roads, and so forth. In the labour process, therefore, man's activity, with the help of the instruments of labour, effects an alteration, designed from the commencement, in the material worked upon. The process disappears in the product. The latter is a use value. Nature's material adapted by a change of form to the wants of man. Labour has incorporated itself with its subject. The former is materialised, the latter transformed. That which in the labourer appeared as movement now appears in the product as a fixed quality without motion. The blacksmith forges, and the product is a forging. If we examine the whole process from the point of view of its result, the product, it is plain that both the instruments and the subject of labour are means of production. Footnote. It appears paradoxical to assert that uncaught fish, for instance, are a means of production in the fishing industry. But hitherto no one has discovered the art of catching fish in waters that contain none. End of footnote. And that the labour itself is productive labour. Footnote. This method of determining, from the standpoint of the labour process alone, what is productive labour, is by no means directly applicable to the case of the capitalist process of production. End of footnote. Though a use value in the form of a product issues from the labour process, yet other use values, products of previous labour, enter into it as means of production. The same use value is both the product of a previous process and a means of production in a later process. Products are therefore not only results, but also essential conditions of labour. With the exception of the extractive industries in which the material for labour is provided immediately by nature, such as mining, hunting, fishing, and agriculture, so far as the latter is confined to breaking up virgin soil, all branches of industry manipulate raw material, objects already filtered through labour, already products of labour. Such is seed in agriculture. Animals and plants, which we are accustomed to consider as products of nature, are, in their present form, not only products of, say, last year's labour, but the result of a gradual transformation, continued through many generations under man's superintendence and by means of his labour. But in the great majority of cases, instruments of labour show even to the most superficial observer traces of the labour of past ages. Raw material may either form the principal substance of a product, or it may enter into its formation only as necessary. An accessory may be consumed by the instruments of labour, as coal under a boiler, oil by a wheel, hay by draft horses, or it may be mixed with the raw material in order to produce some modification thereof, as chlorine into unbleached linen, coal with iron, dye stuff with wool, or again, it may help to carry on the work itself, as in the case of the materials used for heating and lighting workshops. The distinction between principal substance and accessory vanishes in the true chemical industries, because there none of the raw material reappears in its original composition in the substance of the product. Footnote. Storch calls true raw materials matière, and accessory material matériau. Cherbuliez describes accessories as matière instrumentale. End of footnote. Every object possesses various properties, and is thus capable of being applied to different uses. One and the same product may therefore serve as raw material in very different processes. Corn, for example, is a raw material for millers, starch manufacturers, distillers, and cattle breeders. It also enters as raw material into its own production, in the shape of seed. Coal, too, is at the same time the product of, and a means of production in, coal mining. Again, a particular product may be used in one and the same process, both as an instrument of labour and as a raw material. Take, for instance, the fattening of cattle, where the animal is the raw material and at the same time an instrument for the production of manure. A product, though ready for immediate consumption, may yet serve as raw material for a further product, as grapes when they become the raw material for wine. On the other hand, labour may give us its product in such a form that we can use it only as a raw material, as is the case with cotton, thread, and yarn. Such a raw material, though itself a product, may have to go through a whole series of different processes. In each of these, in turn, it serves, with constantly varying form, as raw material, until the last process of the series leaves it a perfect product, ready for individual consumption, or for use as an instrument of labour. Hence we see that whether a use value is to be regarded as raw material, as instrument of labour, or as product, this is determined entirely by its function in the labour process, by the position it there occupies. As this varies, so does its character. Whenever, therefore, a product enters as a means of production into a new labour process, it thereby loses its character of product, and becomes a mere factor in the process. A spinner treats spindles only as implements for spinning, and flax only as the material that he spins. Of course, it is impossible to spin without material and spindles, and therefore the existence of these things as products, at the commencement of the spinning operation, must be presumed. But in the process itself, the fact that they are products of previous labour is a matter of utter indifference, just as in the digestive process, it is of no importance whatever that bread is the produce of the previous labour of the farmer, the miller, and the baker. On the contrary, it is generally by their imperfections as products that the means of production in any process assert themselves in their character of products. A blunt knife or weak thread forcibly remind us of Mr. A. the cutler, or Mr. B. the spinner. In the finished product, the labour, by means of which it has acquired its useful qualities, is not palpable, has apparently vanished. A machine which does not serve the purposes of labour is useless. In addition, it falls a prey to the destructive influence of natural forces. Iron rusts, and wood rots. Yarn, with which we neither weave nor knit, is cotton wasted. Living labour must seize upon these things, and rouse them from their death sleep, change them from mere possible use values into real and effective ones. Bathed in the fire of labour, appropriated as part and parcel of labour's organism, and as it were made alive for the performance of their functions in the process, they are in truth consumed, but consumed with a purpose, as elementary constituents of new use-values, of new products, ever ready as means of subsistence for individual consumption, or as means of production for some new labour process. If, then, on the one hand, finished products are not only results, but also necessary conditions of the labour process, on the other hand, their assumption into that process, their contact with living labour, is the sole means by which they can be made to retain their character of use values and be utilised. Labour uses up its material factors, its subject and its instruments, consumes them, and is therefore a process of consumption. Such productive consumption is distinguished from individual consumption by this, that the latter uses up products as means of subsistence for the living individual, the former as means whereby alone labour, the labour power of the living individual, is enabled to act. The product, therefore, of individual consumption is the consumer himself. The result of productive consumption is a product distinct from the consumer. Insofar, then, as its instruments and subjects are themselves products, labour consumes products in order to create products, or in other words, consumes one set of products by turning them into means of production for another set. But just as in the beginning the only participators in the labour process were man and earth, which latter exists independently of man, so even now we still employ in the process many means of production provided directly by nature that do not represent any combination of natural substances with human labour. The labour process, resolved, as above, into its simple elementary factors, is human action with a view to the production of use values, appropriation of natural substances to human requirements. It is the necessary condition for effecting exchange of matter between man and nature. It is the everlasting, nature-imposed condition of human existence, and therefore is independent of every social phase of that existence, or rather is common to every such phase. It was, therefore, not necessary to represent our labourer in connection with other labourers. Man and his labour on one side, nature and its materials on the other, sufficed. As the taste of porridge does not tell you who grew the oats, no more does this simple process tell you of itself what are the social conditions under which it is taking place, whether under the slave owner's brutal lash or the anxious eye of the capitalist, whether Cincinnatus carries it on in tilling his modest farm, or a savage in killing wild animals with stones. Footnote. By a wonderful feat of logical acumen, Colonel Torrens has discovered in this stone of the savage the origin of capital. Quote, "In the first stone which the savage flings at the wild animal he pursues, in the first stick that he ceases to strike down the fruit which hangs above his reach, we see the appropriation of one article for the purpose of aiding in the acquisition of another, and thus discover the origin of capital. Unquote. R. Torrens, An Essay on the Production of Wealth, etc. End of footnote. Let us now return to our would-be capitalist. We left him just after he had purchased, in the open market, all the necessary factors of the labour process, its objective factors, the means of production, as well as its subjective factor, labour power. With the keen eye of an expert, he has selected the means of production and the kind of labour power best adapted to his particular trade, be it spinning, boot-making, or any other kind. He then proceeds to consume the commodity, the labour power that he has just bought, by causing the labourer, the impersonation of that labour power, to consume the means of production by his labour. The general character of the labour process is evidently not changed by the fact that the labourer works for the capitalist instead of for himself. Moreover, the particular methods and operations employed in boot-making or spinning are not immediately changed by the intervention of the capitalist. He must begin by taking the labour power as he finds it in the market, and consequently be satisfied with labour of such a kind as would be found in the period immediately preceding the rise of capitalists. Changes in the methods of production by the subordination of labour to capital can take place only at a later period, and therefore will have to be treated of in a later chapter. The labour process, turned into the process by which the capitalist consumes labour power, exhibits two characteristic phenomena. First, the labourer works under the control of the capitalist to whom his labour belongs, the capitalist taking good care that the work is done in a proper manner, and that the means of production are used with intelligence, so that there is no unnecessary waste of raw material, and no wear and tear of the implements beyond what is necessarily caused by the work. Secondly, the product is the property of the capitalist and not that of the labourer, its immediate producer. Suppose that a capitalist pays for a day's labour power at its value, then the right to use that power for a day belongs to him, just as much as the right to use any other commodity, such as a horse that he has hired for the day. To the purchaser of a commodity belongs its use, and the seller of labour power, by giving his labour, does no more, in reality, than part with the use-value that he has sold. From the instant he steps into the workshop, the use-value of his labour power, and therefore also its use, which is labour, belongs to the capitalist. By the purchase of labour power, the capitalist incorporates labour as a living ferment with the lifeless constituents of the product. From his point of view, the labour process is nothing more than the consumption of the commodity purchased, that is, of labour power. But this consumption cannot be effected except by supplying the labour power with the means of production. The labour process is a process between things that the capitalist has purchased, things that have become his property. The product of this process belongs, therefore, to him, just as much as does the wine, which is the product of a process of fermentation completed in his cellar. Footnote. Products are appropriated before they are converted into capital. This conversion does not secure them from such appropriation. Cheboulier, Richesse ou Pauvreté, 1841. The proletarian, by selling his labour for a definite quantity of the necessaries of life, renounces all claim to a share in the product. The mode of appropriation of the products remains the same as before. It is in no way altered by the bargain we have mentioned. The product belongs exclusively to the capitalist, who supplied the raw material and the necessaries of life, and this is a rigorous consequence of the law of appropriation, a law whose fundamental principle was the very opposite, namely, that every labourer has an exclusive right to the ownership of what he produces. When labourers receive wages for their labour, the capitalist is then the owner not of the capital only. He means the means of production. But of the labour also. If what is paid as wages is included, as it commonly is, in the term capital, it is absurd to talk of labour separately from capital. The word capital, as thus employed, includes labour and capital both. James Mill, Elements of Political Economy, 1821. End of footnote.